everyone. Welcome back to the show. So Colin is in fact away today in a shocking twist. He is gallivanting somewhere around the continental United States. But I'm very glad that in his place I have the good doctor, Amanda Rabinowitz. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So let's get into this episode of Winners at War. Has this season been living up to the hype for you so far? What's been your taking it through 4/5 episodes, wherever you come down on that?
I think that this is definitely the season that the Survivor community needed. I feel like I was, you know, kind of at a low point in my Survivor fandom coming out of season 39. And I, you know, didn't know how much enthusiasm I would be able to muster for season 40. But then from the moment that those black and white cast photos came out and just the absolute epic nature of everything about this season, I feel like you just can't help but be excited about seeing this cast compete. And I think that, you know, even with that tremendous hype leading in, I think that so far, you know, at this point in the season, it has delivered in, you know, just getting to see how these iconic players assort themselves into groups and deceive each other. And so I think I have no complaints so far.
Yeah, I think that was the concern for many of us, that even though we hoped and expected that the season would re-energize our love for the show, if it didn't, then it's hard to know what would, really. And maybe it would be time to get to grips with the fact that we were just over Survivor and we had to move on and find a new love. So the fact that the show has been able to drag us back in, I think has been really reassuring for a lot of us, and definitely a strong start to the season. Has there been any major surprises so far for you? Things that, you know, maybe players that have performed above or below what you expected for them, or people who were really making a name for themselves that you weren't too jazzed about coming in?
Let's see. I mean, I have to say, there definitely are players that I'm getting a little bit more out of this season than I have in seasons past. Like, I think that the episode that we'll talk about, that we'll talk about tonight, I think that Sarah really probably showed more personality in a couple of scenes of this episode than she did in her two previous games. So I've been kind of delighted to see more of her personality shine through. I mean, we obviously knew that she was a great player and had that skill in her, but to see her shine as a character, that's been a great surprise. And the other surprise I want to note is not somebody that I'm surprised that they have it in them, but I'm surprised that the show is giving us the Sophie that we've all, you know, gotten to know and love from podcasts, but we didn't really get to see shine in the show. So it's been a real pleasant surprise to see so much more of Sophie on this season.
Certainly, yeah. Every Sophie confessional takes me back to those great know-it-alls episodes where she stands in and manages to steal the show for herself. And yeah, Sarah does seem a lot more fun this season. And through this first chapter, we've seen more of that side of her than we did in the entirety of the season that she won. And that's part of why she is a great player, I think. It's not just that when she gets down to business, she does great work. It's that she is fun to be around, and that's what gives her a phenomenal social game, as she would put it. It's that during all of that downtime that makes up 90% of the show, she's fun, and that's what you saw over and over again in the exit interviews for that season. It's, oh, I didn't know Sarah was playing a great cutthroat game. I thought she was just playing hard, but there to play hard as well, you know, to have a lot of fun. So it's great to see that side of her, and I hope we get to see that even more so if she continues to make a deeper run in the season, because that's been definitely a refreshing thing to see so far.
Right. I mean, and I think it's the kind of thing when I heard in exit interviews person after person say that, you know, I thought Sarah was my best friend. I sort of didn't even believe it. But now seeing more in the, you know, even in the limited airtime that we get to see of people goofing around or back at camp, it's you can definitely see how she's able to create those bonds.
On the flip side, are the people who, whether because they're just biding their time or they just are coming in with a different mindset this season or whatever, are the people who you expected to see more from that hasn't materialized yet?
Well, I was thinking when I was rewatching this episode that, I mean, it's amazing to have Boston Rob and Parvati in an alliance together. And seeing that alliance come together in the first episode was, you know, one of those, you know, absolutely, you know, total fan, like, you know, fan service type of moment. Like, it almost felt like fan fiction to write, you know, the sequel to Heroes versus Villains, and now these two team up. But for all of that, I feel like Parvati is sort of seems like a supporting character at this stage of the season, and that's been a little bit disappointing to see that she's not, you know, that we're not seeing it when we're getting the perspective on what she and Rob are doing together. It definitely is edited, at least, to look like Rob is the one making his decisions and just kind of letting Parvati know that her name is out there. And we're not really seeing Parvati's skill in maneuvering the way that we know that she's capable of.
In the same vein as what we said about Sarah, I've been excited to see the variety on offer from Boston Rob so far this season, where we've seen him play from the top, we've seen him have to play from the bottom, which is a really new experience for him. And in this iteration of Boston Rob, the fifth one or sixth one by some counts, I think we're already seeing more new dimensions to his character and more variety from him than we saw again in the season he won and some of the seasons before that too. He really seems to be you know, he's a much more fleshed out character. And maybe that's just because we haven't seen him actually play the game in going on a decade at this point. So of course something new has to open up. But seeing him go through this roller coaster, even within the space of the first four episodes, has been a treat, for sure.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that that's a great thing about these winners. And you know, I think that this season is really like cementing, you know, Boston Rob's place as one of the, you know, the top echelon of player of Survivor is, you know, the you see the neat thing is, you know, in a normal season of Survivor, people get in a bad position and maybe they try to maneuver their way out of it, and maybe they're successful and maybe they're not. But it's been remarkable to see that, you know, when Boston Rob is in a bad position or when Kim is in a bad position, that all of these players really are going to fight for it, and they're going to try to take all of their skills and all of their strategy and all of the social angles that they maneuver and bring that to bear. And that's been really fun to just see that kind of level of play almost across the
I
board.
do agree that Parvati has been more low-key than I expected so far, and she's still getting some good barbs in there, you know, firing some shots at Sandra as we expected, and doing the usual routine, putting Adam in his place and so on and so forth. But by and large, she has been mostly this secondary or tertiary character. But I wonder if that is inevitable given her personality and her play style, where when she's on the top, you know whether you're in or you're out, and the people who are in just idolize Parvati and follow her wherever she goes, and the people who are on the outs just either they desperately want to be one of the cool kids, or Parvati's out there reminding them not to get out of line. So she makes a great villainess when she's in that role. But she can't really play from the bottom because that's what her game is, right? It's being in charge and making you want to be with her when she's in charge. And so when she's not in charge, she just kind of has to hope that things turn around so that she is. And we saw in Heroes versus Villains, you know, if Russell doesn't make that bizarrely bold and aggressive idol play, and Tyson doesn't essentially vote himself out, that's the end of Parvati's storyline. And she doesn't maybe reach that iconic status that we still attach to her 20 seasons later. And so, yeah, in this season, before this swap, which we know is coming in the next episode, she hasn't really been able to get up to much. But then you don't know if that's because she's incapable of switching things up or because that's just where she's found herself. And if she swaps well and has people she can work with, she's going to be the Parvati that we know and many of us love from times gone by.
Yeah, right. That's a great point, because in the early few rounds of Heroes versus Villains, she did kind of have a similar posture that she does so far in this season of kind of being aloof and you know, not really getting her hold in. So I wonder if we'll still see that potential that we know that she has fulfill itself once they swap things up and she's maybe with a different group.
The crucial difference there, I would say, is that in her previous season, even before she really did anything to further cement that all-time villain status, she was seen as radioactive. She was the person who was the most dangerous player on this island, full of all-stars, full of, you know, former winners and some of the greatest of all time. She was the person who everyone had their sights set on. But coming into this season, that's partially true still, kind of. But there were so many other big threats that Parvati doesn't stand head and tail above the pack like she did last time. And I wonder if she's a little resentful of that too. You know, she wants to be the center of attention. She wants to be the belle of the ball.
Yeah, no, but before the season even started, I was thinking that this is, and Survivor's kind of gone in this direction anyway, where it's like anything that makes you a threat makes you not a threat, and then that in turn makes you a threat. And it's kind of like that scene in The Princess Bride where it's, well, clearly I cannot choose the wine in front of mm-hmm. you, and it sort of goes around in circles like that. And I wonder if, like, for some of these obvious threats like Boston Rob and Parvati and Sandra, and you hear that logic coming a little bit from Tony in this episode, that those threats become so large that they start to minimize because those targets, you know, are so obvious that people focus on other things. And I think that maybe Parvati has been a little bit relegated to so much of a threat that it's gone around to the other side, and people are no longer considering her somebody that it's important to get out at this stage of the game.
It's that classic Dr. Will line of, I made the target on my back so big that it became invisible. And it's a risky thing to do, because if sometimes it becomes so big that it's just so big and it's unavoidable and you end up getting clipped. But if it works, then it works out great. And we said going into Game Changers with Tony and even with Sandra too, that for some of these people, they were going to need to have a bad season. They would need to have a season off before they could really come back and be able to play the game fairly again. And Tony did that, right? We saw him in Game Changers. He certainly didn't help himself, but I don't know if there was any way he was going to be allowed to make a deep run in that season. But now that a few years have passed and we've seen him fail once, and the idea of Tony is just this strange maniac that you can't make any sense of, that has receded a little bit. And even if it's still there for some people, when you stack that up against Parvati herself and Rob and Sandra and Kim and all these other people in the cast, it's easy to kind of fade back into the woodwork a little bit.
Right. I mean, and that's just like the delightful thing about this season is, you know, everybody is a threat. Who do you target? There's a case to make for everybody. And then those cases become so obvious that we forget about them. So, I mean, it's been really neat to watch how that plays out, especially with the people like Amber and Danny and some of those people that were preseason being talked about as those kind of under the radar female players that are most likely to emerge at the end of these All-Star games, at least historically, to see them go out early and really all of these big threatening players remain has been, it's been a really interesting dynamic to watch.
And we see with Australian Survivor All-Stars, which is running concurrently to this, you have more of a Game Changers feel to that, where, or even the original All-Stars, where so many of the people that got the most excitement and chatter coming into the season were all gone before their time. And so now we're getting into more of a stagnating game where there's still a lot of it left to be played. And that's because every season of Australian Survivor is a marathon, basically. It's hours and hours before you can get anywhere. But part of that, too, is that, you know, you have a lot of the fan favorites are gone. And so you only have one or two people left who are swanning up the whole airtime. And some of the ones who you thought you would be excited to see back are still there and making a deep run, but they're just not getting any kind of screen time or attention. And they're struggling to make themselves known in the game. So that is, yeah, hopefully an unfavorable contrast to what we're getting here, where it feels like it is still anyone's game to win, and lots of people are really in the mix and keeping themselves with a high profile.
Well, I have several failed attempts to watch a whole season of Australian Survivor. The first season since it came back from and I tried to watch this upcoming All-Stars because I love Nick, but I haven't made it through. But I think that's the whole idea of when you cast an All-Star season, how it's critical that you can match the entire cast on that threat level dimension. And I think that the successful All-Stars seasons have been able to do that to a greater degree. And that was kind of one of the fatal flaws of Game Changers, was that there really was a very, very clear top tier of player. And then there was a big drop off. I had never been one of the people who was really, enthusiastic that we had to have an all winners season. I thought that something like Winners and Legends or some sort of mix, but now seeing it play out, I do think that there is something about the fact that we know that every one of these people can win the game, that they have won, they have that ego that they want to maintain their position as a winner. I do think that there's something magical about having everybody at least be equal on that dimension that is making it, so we're actually seeing people play and we're not seeing that phenomenon of threats getting targeted and ending up with maybe some of the less dynamic players remaining at the end of the game.
To jump ahead a little bit, we saw a nod to that in that scene with Rob and Michelle, where Michelle was saying about how she got a lot of backlash after her season and that really affected her and took away some of the pride and enjoyment that she was able to feel in that win. And Rob was reassuring her that, hey, look, you're on this season, right? You won just like everyone else. So you're on this equal footing with them, and no one can take that away from you.
Yeah, that was totally fascinating that scene was included in the show, because I really feel like that might be like a new sort of mark for how meta Survivor is going to allow itself to be. And to have, you know, Michelle actually not only remarking on how she played the game, but also how she played the game and then how that gameplay was perceived by the fan community. That kind of acknowledgement of the fan community, to me, really marked a departure from anything that Survivor has done before. I mean, I think that players have talked about the audience in kind of this amorphous way, but to refer to like the online portion of the Survivor community, which is clearly, I think, what Michelle was referring to, that I think is kind of a really massive shift in what Survivor's been willing to do. And it was interesting to see Michelle talk about that with, with Boston Rob, of all people, who is also somebody who, lost to Amber, his wife, who at the time was considered an undeserving winner. He's won seasons where people have said it was kind of set up for him and he had a cakewalk. So to have a player like Rob, who is sort of adored as being one of the greatest players, but has had this controversial relationship with the fan community in the past, and then have somebody like Michelle, I just thought that was something that, like, in the movie of Survivor, if you wanted to draw up a scene, I think that would be a pretty fitting scene to make reference to what the fan community of what the fan community's relationship with the show and the players is.
And Rob is still on the heels of season 39 being promoted as the star of the franchise, maybe its most iconic player, one of its greatest winners of all time. Certainly he has the best storyline maybe of any winner, even though what made that so engaging came, 6 years before he even won the game. So he is Boston Rob. He has this iconic legacy within the franchise, almost regardless of what happens to him on this season. Whereas for Michelle, I think she certainly is feeling the pressure of, if I go out early, that is going to validate for all the people who doubted me in the past, all the haters, that's going to validate in their minds everything that they said about me and prove that my win was a fluke or whatever. And it's an interesting discussion for them to even show, bearing in mind that on this season, when it happens, we will have a Final Four fire making challenge in this new format, in part because the backlash to Michelle's win was so intense with Jeff that he wanted to overhaul the entire format of the endgame to stop something like that from happening again. And it feels like the show itself has been pushing this line for years that Aubrey was robbed and Michelle didn't really deserve to win. And that's right. Why we have to take these measures to stop that happening again. So to see, firstly, just Michelle on this season at all, and then also for them to air that conversation, I don't know if that's their way of apologizing in part, just a slight gesture in that direction, or maybe they are kind of giving Michelle the chance to show what she can really do and prove them wrong as well as everyone else.
It's another classic Michelle winner edit.
Yeah. See, not to dive headfirst into the edit zone here, but I couldn't stop myself from dwelling on that scene. That seemed like if she was going to be the only person to repeat Sandra's feat. Like, that's a pretty good scene to set that up with.
Right. But no, I think you're totally right about this show being conscious of the way that it viewed Michelle, and particularly the way that Jeff has viewed Michelle's win. And I wouldn't be surprised if on the cutting room floor, there was part of that conversation where Michelle says, you know, Jeff hates me and doesn't think I deserve to win. But it is really interesting, like you said, that in this kind of meta way, now there'll be a Final Four fire making challenge. Maybe Michelle is the one to win that Final Four fire making challenge. We can only speculate, but that, you know, there are these other twists and turns now that have made the game in the minds of some less pure or less fair, but around this whole idea of who is a deserving winner.
And I wonder how that dialogue is going to come into play on this season, where it's tempting to think that people will just look within the confines of what happened to them this season and their experience as a self-contained thing with that player, but it's hard to ignore someone's legacy as a whole. So, you know, normally if it's a season of all first timers, if you get in there and someone seems like they did nothing within the game or whatever, and they're trying to spin that as, well, I was playing under the radar and I was working my magic behind the scenes and none of you ever really got to see it before it was too late, you might not be willing to believe that coming from them. But if it's someone who has a proven record, let's say, of doing that to win their season and thereby earning their spot on this one, you're going to give that more credibility, I'd imagine. So it will be interesting to see how, when it has to be discussed in those very explicit terms, if that past record of achievement comes into play at all.
Right. And not just the past record of achievement. I also think you can't discount the personal relationships that so many of these players have with one another that I think, you know, really can't be ignored, because I know that as fans, we're really, really tough on players who on jurors who vote in part based on, you know, who is their friend or who do they have the best relationship with. And, you know, I can definitely understand that perspective. But I think that part of it comes from, like, when somebody is your friend, you can empathize with them in a way and understand their decision making with a greater depth of understanding than you can if you've just observed somebody in a game and don't really know what they were doing. And I think in this season where these players are known quantities, either because we've seen the footage of them from a prior season or because, you know, maybe these players have personal relationships where they can understand that, okay, you know, this is the way that, like, for example, this is the way that, you know, Sandra plays. And I know that even though she was saying this, she was probably thinking something else. I think that you're willing to give people more credit for their moves being strategic and being savvy and understanding where they're coming from when you have that history with them, whether it's personal history or just history with knowing how they play the game.
Mm-hmm. There's also this interesting discussion that happens over people like being starstruck. We saw that this excuse me, at Tribal Council, but you know, like Nick was saying that Parvati was his crush back in high school, and that you know, we saw Ben get tongue-tied around Boston Rob because he just didn't seem like he was ready to play in the big leagues just yet. And I think there's definitely a sense, especially with some of these newer winners, that okay, all right, sure, you were able to win your season, but back in my day, like, we had it so much harder or whatever, and you will have to prove yourself to earn that same legitimacy in the eyes of the all-time greats, the people who have played three, four, or five times at this point. And I think that comes into play differently for some people than for others. Like when Kim was trying to say, join the pylon and say, yeah, I'm a little starstruck too. It's like, okay, Kim, sure you are. It's like, she knows perfectly well that so many people here are starstruck to see her and to play with her. But I think that definitely, you know, like if, let's say, Adam or Nick or Ben gets to the finals, there will be this sense of like, are they out of their depth? You know, are they really equipped to handle this the same way that, you know, if Boston Rob is able to get to the finals for a third time, or Parvati makes her third appearance there,
Yeah, they have this level of gravitas. And I think that there's, I found it actually a really amusing running thread, though, whenever these conversations about being starstruck come up or being in the presence of legends, because you have to choose your words very carefully so you're not excluding anybody from that legendary tier of people that makes you starstruck. I think at first, we first hear it when Wendell is saying, I see some legends here. Yeah. I see 19 legends. And then, you know, Sarah has to, or Kim sort of looks at Sarah and says, I'm starstruck by you. And it's like, okay, come on, Kim, you know, she played after you. And it's been a kind of a funny dance that people have to do. They want to say that some of these people are legends, but then once you make it not fully inclusive, you're counting people out and no one wants to do that.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into the episode itself here. And like it did, we'll start with Edge of Extinction, where we have to go there for our weekly check-in, take up a good 5-10 minutes of the show that could be easily devoted to all manner of antics going on the island itself. But instead, we're going over to Natalie and Amber and Danny, and our most recent addition there, which is Ethan. This is kind of an odd group to have assembled there early on, where many of us were sad to lose Natalie so early, but we're not losing her completely, and she will be one of the most prominent figures over there on the Edge every week. And I think that's welcome in some ways, because had it just been Danny and Amber and, you know, let's say the Nick move had worked this week and he's there instead, if you are just filling up the Edge with some of these less notable or less telegenic figures, then that feels like more of a chore and a distraction than it even would normally. Whereas if you do lose some of these big hitters, you at least get the chance to see them again in this new capacity. So it's almost like it balances out the range of outcomes you could have with the show itself, where you would be mortified to lose. Certainly lots of people were mortified to see Ethan gone so early, but you get to see Ethan again in this very heartwarming scene this week. Whereas if you didn't really care one way or the other, if you saw Danny get voted out, well, now you have to see Danny again every single week. So it's almost like you smooth things over and you make sure that it's roughly the kind of the same experience for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, I have really, really conflicting feelings about Edge of Extinction this season. I think it's kind of a nightmare from a storytelling point of view to do anything that resembles service to what's going on in Edge of Extinction, and then also balance that with this completely different story of what's going on in the main game. First of all, we don't know if the person who returns from Edge is even on Edge right now. So, unless you're kind of trying to thread the winner's story through Edge, whatever's going on there is probably not going to be terribly relevant to the major story of the season. But all of that said, that's not to say that what's going on at Edge isn't interesting and I'm not enjoying watching it, because I have been enjoying watching it. I think that it's been a really great showcase for some of the things that make Natalie Anderson such a kind of special and really intriguing player, like just her sheer grit and toughness and doggedness and competitive spirit. That's really been on display, and seeing her dominate there has been really a nice consolation, because it was a shame to see her go out first. And then the Ethan, you know, storyline of going up and, you know, finishing that challenge, having to be attended to by medical, hearing more of his story with cancer. I thought that was incredibly moving. I cried during that when they all came back and did the last leg with him and they had that emotional experience. I mean, I thought that stuff was great. I didn't think it was, you know, I know that there were some people who loved it and some people who were like, why did we spend all this time with that? I think that it's good stuff. And I think it captures something that I've always liked about Survivor, about the show, that we get less of in its most modern incarnation, which is more of just like people going through something very difficult together. That there used to be, I think, more of those long, grueling challenges, or we got to see more of the demands of what it was like to be at camp. And we don't see quite as much of that anymore. And I do like that. And I like that it's been threaded with this competitive aspect where, you know, people are trying to get these fire tokens and they're actually, even though they're cooperating quite a bit to live together, they're also deceiving each other and being opportunistic. So I think that that's all been great. But like I said, it's just not clear how any of that will pay off in the whole main part of the game. And that makes it a little bit tough to reconcile.
We also don't really have a good sense here of what does one fire token mean? What does it count for? How much can you really exchange it for? Like when this week's task where you have to make 20 treks up and down that staircase to retrieve the logs, you don't know how arduous one journey is to begin with. So maybe this is a completely trivial task, or maybe it's like a labor of Hercules. Like you don't know where on that spectrum this is going to land. And then the reward is just one fire token if you complete it, and you don't know how much that's worth either. So it's hard to get fully invested in any one of these tasks when it's so hard to tell what the stakes really are. If they successfully complete it, are you going to think, well, what, you idiot, why did you do all of that just for one fire token? Or are you going to think, wow, that's a really strong commitment to bring to the game, and I'm so glad they did it, even though the reward seems, you know, so minimal or intangible.
Right. Yeah, and I guess we saw that menu in the first episode where we could get some, like, we could sort of set some value of the fire tokens. I think that there were multiple fire tokens for a 6-pack of cold beer. I don't know how many fire tokens is a jar of peanut butter. We should get a fire token conversion rate, especially now that we know that Natalie Anderson is the Michael Bloomberg of Edge of Extinction. Maybe we can use that to work backwards. No, I would never. I love Natalie Anderson.
Yes. Good save. This segment, I think my view is the same as the consensus that I've seen, which is this is great stuff, this is great content, but I don't know why I'm watching it in an episode of Survivor, and especially an episode of this Survivor season where there is so much to cram into those 40 minutes, where I would love it if this was some kind of extra bonus content that was online somewhere, or I still had access to it, but it wasn't taking away valuable minutes of the show. And there is a larger point to be made there that just having Edge of Extinction, we're not getting exit interviews this season because Edge is there, and right. So we don't get that behind the scenes look at the what's going on in the show. And even if when these people are finally ejected from the Edge and out of the game, maybe they don't even get individual interviews first of all, and if they do, no one's going to really think to ask them or care what happened 6 weeks ago that no one remembers anymore. So a lot of that ongoing developing history of the game just isn't there, so we don't get that additional stuff that we're craving for every week, and now we don't even get to see as much of what's going on in the game just directly, because 10 minutes of that has to be taken up with Edge of Extinction. So on this season, where more than any other I would be devouring every morsel of information I could possibly get, there's just none left anymore, and that a lot of that is Edge of Extinction's fault.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. I mean, I think the best thing about Edge of Extinction this season was that it was harder to get spoiled on like how deep people went in the game based on how much weight they had lost when they came back. That was a plus, or who they were, you know, friendly with on social media. So it eliminated some of that preseason speculating, which was nice. But I mean, I think that this is a much better version of Edge of Extinction than what we saw in the first outing. So I do think that giving them something meaningful to do that at least interfaces with the game in this kind of fire token exchange back and forth, that adds some value to it. But again, I think that you're totally right. With so much good, valuable stuff going on in the game itself, it does seem to take up time. So, I mean, I guess that at this point, we don't think that it's going to come back. But there might be a way to tweak it in a future season. But from a storytelling point of view, that was more satisfying.
As a doctor, did you have any particular opinion on this, the arduous nature of this trek and Ethan's brief medical alert here?
Well, I am not actually a medical doctor. While I, talk off the cuff about something I don't know, take that with a grain of salt. Oh, no, I'll reiterate, I'm not a medical doctor, but when I watch these medical interventions with the survivors, I think like, oh, I could probably do that. They told them, you're going to faint. Stop marching up and down this this incredibly steep mountain 20 times. I don't have any specific comments on that. But I mean, it was a scary moment. I was glad that he was safe and everything was okay. I mean, I wonder about these really, really grueling physical challenges, just how hard that's going to push people and just how much survivors comfortable with that. Because you can imagine people at varying levels of fitness can probably not do that safely.
Not trying to blow your cover here by any means, but I wonder if they deliberately made it a lot harder than it needed to be, because as much as they don't want to see our sweet angel Ethan getting hurt any more than the rest of us do, they know that there's been a lot of skepticism about the Edge of Extinction twist and just how tough it can really be to just sit there and live on the island for a few weeks. So to show this level of having to just push yourself through this incredible physical boundary for such a meager reward, I think they see that as validating the idea behind the twist, that we will make you suffer almost just for the hell of it in order to prove a point. And when you frame it in those terms, it doesn't sound like such a good idea, but I think that is kind of baked into what they're going for here, and that has to be that has to be the understanding for this to even work.
Yeah, I totally agree. When you hear Jeff talk about Edge, and he seems to really be enthusiastic about the concept, like what is appealing to him is this idea that people are willing to suffer in abject misery for an indeterminate amount of time for just the smallest increase in chance in winning this game, which is really kind of, masochistic and dark when you think about it. But that seems to be what Jeff loves about it. And that's what I think, with the Reem and the large role she played in the edit, that they were really tickled by was that this person who was out first and had almost no chance of winning the game, had she re-entered, that she stuck out this whole time and showed herself that she was capable of something that she never otherwise would have known. So I definitely think that this challenge was meant to sort of push that concept to the fore.
Yeah, coming off of the eponymous Edge of Extinction season, so many of them said that the Edge provided them with this unique opportunity for challenging themselves and self-reflection, where when you're in the game itself is kind of clowning everything. But when you're put in this setting, which is adjacent to the game and resembles it in many ways and still has this incredible deprivation and so on, then you are really being pushed to your limits. But in a way that gives you a different experience. So I can definitely see some of that. And, at the time, like when you heard Aubrey, for instance, talk about how this was some life-changing experience, you wonder how much of that was compensating for the fact that the main game itself didn't go the way that she'd hoped. And that if she could tell herself and tell the world that she had found this incredible, unique thing on the Edge of Extinction, then that would kind of redeem her having been there and redeem the concept. But I'll be interested to see as people come off the edge this season if they're mostly saying the same thing.
Yeah, Wibby, we had that moment where they, where all four of the current inhabitants like talked about how meaningful it was to them. Amber had the confessional about how they've really grown so close, and those moments where they're all crying together. It seems like, I mean, I can imagine that, being in that kind of misery with other people probably is a very powerful experience.
Mm-hmm. So back on the island itself, Adam is starting to make his apology tour. But before then, he's going to be working himself back into everyone's good graces by working the hardest that anyone has ever seen him work. He's going to be gathering firewood and filling up people's canteens for them and doing everything that you need to keep your house in top shape. So while he's doing that, everyone else is looking at him just kind of bemused at the corner of their eye. And Jeremy knows what's up. He realizes that this is Adam just doing everything he can to, buy himself a little bit of favor. And Jeremy's having some fun with it. But Rob and Parvati are maybe having even more fun with it, where after this brief conversation with Adam, where they're trying to feel him out and make him say something that's going to bury himself, he calls them out on that and says that he's not going to give them anything. And so they decide, we don't actually need him to say anything. We'll just make something up and bury him regardless. And I think it's a sign of the lowest esteem in which he's held by certainly the two of them, Bhavati, but maybe the group as a whole at this point, that he's seen as someone where it would be so easy just to bury him and end his whole career. Whereas someone who has more respect in the group or a higher standing, you couldn't do that so easily. It wouldn't be so trivial.
Right. I mean, and Rob and Parvati are just so cold-blooded in that scene too. And I mean, that's, I think the genius of their alliance is just that they're completely cutthroat, bordering on sociopathic. Like the second Adam leaves, they're like, you just want to bury him. And Parvati's like, I'm in. I thought that Jeremy's confessional was really, really funny about Adam working around camp. Like he was one of his kids who had just gotten in trouble. And that really resonated to me because I've actually thought that there's times that Adam has this kind of poutiness this season that is reminiscent of my own children. but it is unfortunate to see that Adam seems to be struggling so much in this get to get his footing in the tribe right now. I know that you and Colin are big fans of Adam. Maybe do you think that he's misplayed his reintegration into the tribe after last week's blunder?
Well, we were called out this week on a Reddit thread for just being madly in love with Adam and not being able to put our bias aside and see how terribly he was playing. So I'm not going to lavish praise on him, but his whole shtick, I think, and why he has been successful in the past is that he's very good at rebounding from these self-inflicted mistakes by seeming appropriately like penitent and working his way back in and doing what he needs to do to turn that around for himself. But that's the kind of thing which is, I think, a lot easier with a cast of people who don't know what you're up to and are more willing to be open-minded. Whereas this cast, they've all seen Adam's game before. They know how he works. And he is, as one of them said, he's a slippery little sucker. You know, you give him an inch or take a mile and he'll wriggle his way out of the situation. So I don't know how well that's going to land with this group, unfortunately.
Yeah, I worry about him. I think that Adam's saving grace is that whether he's making a good move or making a bad move, he is self-aware enough to recognize how that's been received and try to adjust. So I think that in his winning seasons, there were plenty of times that he probably misplayed. And I don't know if his strategic instincts are always spot on, but I think that he's definitely, observant and self-aware and has the presence to recognize when things are going poorly and try to make amends.
One of his saving graces in the past has been that he's just very likable. And even though he does have this arrogant streak about him, or at times it can come across like he is kind of getting too much in love with himself, by and large, I think people do really warm to Adam and like him. The difference this season is I don't know if they respect him enough, and I don't know how crucial that distinction is going to be.
Yeah, I wonder if he's too millennial for this group of players. I mean, his winning season was millennials versus Gen X, and there was a little bit of the theme of, these entitled millennials and, we're these hardened, grizzled Gen Xers, which is obviously the Gen X stereotype, I suppose. But, at least there he had a lot of age peers in that group. And in this group, he's, younger. He doesn't have a family. He doesn't have the same sort of standing in his life situation just because by virtue of his age. And because this is one of the older casts in Survivor history, and because that there's probably the higher number of people who do have children of their own than we usually see, I wonder if Adam is a little bit more likely to be seen as sort of this petulant you know, younger person who is, you know, kind of that's not going to necessarily earn their respect the way he was able to earn the respect of, say, you know, Jay or Hannah or, you know, some of the people that he played with.
And with Colin gone for the week, it's good to have another grizzled Gen Xer in here with me to offer the other side of the story on that divide. But we did see that Adam, in, you know, he won a unanimous jury vote, and that included many Gen Xers. You know, he got the Bretts and the Chris Hammondses and the Chris's Hammonds and the
Chris's Hammonds,
the Sundays of the world. So he needed to get the respect of all of those people, and he did. But I do think there is a worthwhile larger point there, that both in terms of the show itself, where, you know, Adam's season is comparatively recent, and then just the age gap that really exists on the season, which is the oldest average cast of all time, and Adam is one of the few people on this entire group who's still in his 20s. I do think he might struggle to gain respect. And if I look at the other people that I would say that for here, like Nick, maybe Michelle, they all share those same things of their recent winners, and in part because of that, they're also the younger winners. And that really sets them apart from the group in a way that might be hard to overcome.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is, I don't know how true that is of Sophie, who, because she won when she was so young, I think she was 22, 21 at the time, she's now, I think she's 30 as the season's filming, so she's not much older than any of the people in that group. And yet she, maybe it's because she feels like more of an old soul in general, but it seems like she is much more kind of in tune with the vibe of certainly the tribe that she's on right now than any of the others are.
Yeah, I think that that's a good point. I mean, Sophie definitely didn't seem like a 22-year-old even when she, or 21-year-old even when she played. I do think that she does have that quality of being a little bit wise beyond her years. I also think that she's been lucky that she's been able to get in that group with Wendell and Yul and Nick. So it's those four. I was going to forget Sophie just like Tyson did, but that was where we started. So I think that four is a good four for her, where she and Yul kind of have, where they're, there's a way that they can pair off and have this, you know, this chemistry within that group, where I don't think that age differences are as salient.
Yeah. And so within that group, you have Nick and Wendell, who maybe are closer to her in age and also in generation wise in Survivor terms. And yet she and Yul seem to be on the same wavelength, just, you know, much more than any other combination in that group does.
Mm-hmm.
I really am excited to see where that Yul and Sophie pairing can go. And, you know, if, let's say, they end up on different tribes after this upcoming swap, then maybe that creates a little bit of tension where both of them are gathering their allies separately and trying to set up a parachute for themselves in case things go wrong. And so if they are able to reunite, then maybe that's a tension that's going to become really fun to see boil to the surface. But then also, if they stay together, I kind of want that to happen too, just so we get to see them in action together.
Yeah, I would love to see that pair stay together. As excited as I was to see Parvati and Rob align in that first season, I was like 100 times more excited to see Sophie and Yul pair up. I don't think I had even predicted preseason that they would be two that would work together, but I just love the idea of, you know, the way that both of them are extremely analytic in the way that they view the game, but still, I think, have very different perspectives. I think that they're just a really interesting duo. And they're also both, I think, socially, this, and I think that this is also, that has to, plays into that age thing that we were talking about earlier. You know, Adam is younger than a lot of people in his tribe, but I think that the way that he is sort of social and emotionally expressive, it sort of plays up that age difference. Whereas I think Sophie has this kind of stoicism about her, where she's not going to be viewed as vulnerable or, you know, emotionally, expressive in the same way. And I think that that's one of the things that makes her, that might prevent her from falling, from getting pigeonholed as, you know, somebody who is, you know, less, is immature in some way. Not that I'm saying that Adam is immature at all. But I think that that she and Yule are a very interesting pair because they both have this kind of slight roboticism in the way that they're social. So seeing the way that they navigate a social game with those two analytic minds, I think is really interesting.
That might just be Sophie being half British. That's just how all of us are to some extent. But you're right that Adam definitely has a much younger energy, whereas Sophie is much more in keeping with this older crowd. And I think people who can play both sides of that divide are going to have a good time. So Wendell might actually be in a good spot here where he's young enough that he can hang with the younger kids. And he has hung with one of the younger kids in Michelle before. And that's going to be a developing storyline, perhaps. But also, I think he's old enough that he can, you know, fit into the vibe of the older group, the people who are maybe in their 40s.
Yeah, well, I mean, Wendell is not a kid. I think at the time that the season filmed, I think he's 36, maybe?
Somewhere in that range,
35 or 36. So, I mean, I think that Wendell is like, you know, one of those very, you know, fun, loving sort of has this vibe where he can definitely... I think probably, you know, hang out with people who are 10 years younger than him and fit right in, and they won't feel like they're hanging around this older guy. He finds a way to, he's chameleon-like in that way that he can, I think, hang out with people who are 10 years younger than him. And then, you know, also fit in great with obviously Dom, who was not a whole lot older than Wendell, but a family man in a very different stage of life. I think that he's able to fit into these different groups and sort of change his vibe accordingly. And he definitely fits in with that group of younger sort of new school winners.
As we move over to the other tribe now with Dekal, we see Sarah and Tyson bonding, which is a pretty unlikely pair, but it almost kind of makes perfect sense when you think about it and see them in action.
Yeah, I mean, that was, so they're like smelling each other's fish breath and having this like adorable, you know, who's your favorite person? My favorite person is Sarah conversation. This, like I said, you know, earlier, this was definitely the most personality and appeal that I had read from Sarah, you know, and having watched her over these few seasons. And, you know, and I think that, you know, I could definitely see how Sarah is a fun person to hang out with. I was totally reminded of how funny and charming Tyson is. So, you know, that was definitely a fun scene.
Are you finding yourself enjoying, and I guess it's a moot point now, but were you enjoying one of those tribes more than the other? Because I found for me, a lot of the people I was most excited by coming into the season were on Dekal, like the Yule and Sophie team. And then also in practice, you know, some of the bigger figures from the other tribe, like Parvati, were, and certainly Denise, who we have seen basically nothing of this entire season in the past few episodes. It really felt like that pink tribe is where all the fun was for me.
Yeah, I mean, the two tribes really shook out, so they had very different energy. I mean, I think that it just seemed very fun and goofy and, you know, and but like a lot of the kind of bigger characters on the Dekal side. And then over in the Sele tribe, I think everything seemed much more serious and intense. And I don't think that I was like enjoying one more than the other. They just had really different feelings. Like, I mean, I found Ethan very compelling. Seeing Parvati and Rob work together was really interesting. You know, Adam was, I was enjoying all of that. So I think I like players on both sides of that divide, but there was definitely, it seemed like a stark contrast in terms of what the energy was.
It does look like we're getting new tribes in this upcoming episode, and this is pretty late for that to happen, all things considered. The trend recently has been to swap as often and as early as possible, which it can be good in some ways. It always keeps things live and up and interesting, but it also means you never really get a chance to see things settle on those tribes for very long. And I think one of the times before this that they went the longest, either without swapping or just didn't swap at all, was Heroes versus Villains, where we have several alumni from that cast over here, and also thematically, you know, those two seasons are pretty similar. So what did you make of the fact that we got to see a full, you know, four or five episodes with these groups together? What did you make of that?
I mean, I think that I prefer that, to get a chance to see, you know, how these dynamics play out. I think you can really see what players are capable of when they're forced to stay in those groups. You know, can somebody get control? Can they keep control? How does somebody on the outs deal with that? So I enjoy it. And I wonder if it's a sign that production just has more faith in the players when they let that happen, because it does seem like they are eager to mix things up, and probably, you know, too early. I think it's fun to do it sometimes, but I think it's been predictable every season that they do a swap after a couple of votes. And I think that at this point, at least in my viewing, I enjoy letting things sit for a while and really seeing, you know, how these tribe dynamics evolve.
It does seem that we were getting to the point where if either of those tribes had to go to tribal again, maybe it would be a fairly straightforward vote, where on Dakar, maybe you follow up that easy Tyson vote with an easy Kim vote just to keep things unified. Mm-hmm. And maybe Sophie tries to mix it up a little bit so that she has Kim as an ally, and maybe they could bring the two halves of that idol together. But by and large, it seemed like it would make sense for everyone involved just to knock off Kim and move forward. And then on the other team, maybe Adam's goose was finally cooked, and Rob and Parvati were able to wriggle out of that again. So if you think those storylines are mostly spoken for by now, why not mix it up and see what they can do with new groups? But yeah, I think it is maybe a good show of confidence from the producers in the cast, where, like, if you think some of these outcomes may not be as exciting as these flashy blindsides that we're used to, if you can rely on the cast themselves to still deliver because they're fun and engaging and they're keeping things interesting, then that's still okay. And you can still make that into a good episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's always like the struggle with Survivor, you know, all of these twists and advantages, you know, they're there to protect the game from getting predictable. But I think without them, you get to see the opportunity for players to, you know, maybe Adam can reverse his fate, or maybe, you know, somebody can get something else going or get antsy and make a different move. And when those gambles pay off and we get to see players play, I think that that's the thing that the fans really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. So on Dakar here, we're going to see everyone going through the motions, and there's going to be the usual decoy vote with Nick. My impression was that was never really close to coming together, and it seemed like Tyson was a marked man and he knew it from the outset here.
Yeah, so when I rewatched it, I was watching with an eye towards was Tyson always going to go home, and did actually DeCall go so far as to throw the challenge to get rid of Tyson? Which I think, you know, that's been an idea that's been floated. And I think at a minimum, Tyson was the boot, and it was never really going to go to Nick. I do think that it's clear that at least Tony, I believe, was considering, you know, maybe trying to keep Tyson around. I do think that that pitch that Tyson made appealed to Tony, but largely I think the writing was on the wall, and the Nick decoy was never going to come together.
It seemed like, if anything, Adam was the one trying to throw that challenge with his performance there. But
right.
I wonder if, because they, as far as I know, they still have the chance to kind of walk through the challenge and try it out a little bit in advance. I have to imagine if they knew just how high those buoys with the keys were, or boys with the keys, if you're so inclined, that it felt like they would have put someone taller like a Jeremy in there instead, rather than having Adam just, you know, futilely hopping up and trying to grab it every single time.
Right. I'm looking. So Adam was the only person who was able to do it on the blue tribe. And I think that it was Denise who was a terrible choice there. Right.
Right. I mean, through no fault of her own, that's just her being 5 feet tall. There's not much you can do with that. But Yeah, because when I watched it the first time live, I wasn't paying too much attention to the challenge. So I came away thinking everyone else had just done it as a pretty routine exercise, whereas Adam was flubbing it over and over again. But then when I rewatched it, it seemed like everyone was having trouble the first time at least, and most of them had to take two shots at it. And then, you know, Adam goes back in and keeps trying to get it and gets a lot of flack for not getting it quickly enough. But he was the one they put in there, right? And they could very easily have sent someone else in. And if they knew exactly how hard it was going to be, then obviously you send in Jeremy, who's this giant, and he just easily gets it every time.
So I took notes on this, and so on the DeKal tribe, it was Nick got two of them and Kim got one. And Kim is very tall, but Nick, you know, I think he strikes me as an average size man, tall but not gigantic. And then on the blue tribe, Parv missed three times that we saw. Denise missed once, and I think that they kept her out of it. But Adam was the only one who actually could get those buoys. So I definitely think that height was a factor. Somehow Nick was able to perform relatively better in that challenge.
Yeah, still not quite sure how that works, but in any case, it did seem to work. And when we get to the puzzle portion, we're mixing up the puzzle rosters here a bit, where like Sophie for a change is not on the puzzle, right? And then so we're despite her just crushing the previous two, so it seemed like, based on what Jeff was saying, this was going to be an absolute blowout. And there's a certain boy who cried wolf thing with Jeff in these challenges, where it seemed like every other challenge these days is the biggest blowout of all time. So you don't really believe it at first. But this one did seem like it was going to be very hard to come back. And they did it anyway. And it was pretty impressive to watch, frankly.
Yeah, the comeback was really impressive. And I have to say, like, I really enjoyed Rob having some puzzle redemption there. I don't like to see, you know, my heroes destroyed, and having Rob really flub on a puzzle. I didn't enjoy that. So I did like seeing the puzzle team of Rob and Michelle get redemption here. But Nick and Sarah were on the puzzle for DeKal, and Jeff said that this was a challenge that the Davids had won on David versus Goliath, and Nick was I think he insinuated that Nick was the puzzle maker. I don't remember that exactly. But they really seemed to be doing very poorly on this puzzle. Do you think it's possible that they threw this challenge?
It's possible, and they gave us enough material to try and conjure up some conspiracy theories about it. But do you think it would make sense for them to throw the challenge here? And when we say for them, who are we talking about in particular? Like, who would be masterminding this?
So that's what I was trying to kind of connect to the, I got my whole, like, my pegboard and the threads together to try to connect all of this in conspiracy. But, first of all, if they did throw the challenge, they probably wouldn't have given us edit material to suggest that, because that would have undermined their decoy boot in Nick, right? If Nick was like a key player in throwing the challenge to execute this plan. So I wonder if Sandra has been gunning for Tyson and really wants Tyson out at this stage. And I think that, like, to the extent that her feud with the Marianos is a real thing, when she had that confessional about how mad she was at Boston Rob for not telling her that she was on the that he was going to be on the season, at first I thought that she was just, you know, trying to get a confessional into the show, that she was just sort of vamping for screen time. But it's possible that's, it does sound like from other people's reports that that's true. And even if it weren't true, at this point, Sandra was part of a vote to eliminate Amber. So if they weren't at war at the start of the season, I think that they probably are now. And I can imagine Sandra being very concerned about giving Rob such a good soldier in Tyson. So, and it also sounds like Tyson, you know, like their early days in the tribe when Tyson was targeting Sandra, that is not something that she's comfortable with either. So I can see Sandra being extremely gung-ho about getting rid of Tyson before a swap.
And even if they misjudge it and they have to go to another vote after that, you have Kim there who seemingly you can just pick off with the same group that was going to pick off Tyson, and mostly for the same reasons. So even in like the worst case from that standpoint, you have another vote ready to go. And it may even be worth, you know, throwing again at that point just to make sure that Kim goes if she's going to fill exactly the same position. But that does make a lot of sense. And with the way that whole group seemed to coalesce around the Tyson vote, you know, that seemed to make sense for the Yule and Sophie alliance too, right? Just taking Tyson out of the game as this variable who's not on your side. For the other group, do any of them, no one's making the accusation that they did, but do any of them have a real interest in going to tribal this round, do you think?
So I don't think so. That's, I think, where the theory is the weakest. So, I mean, I can see, and we don't really see, and I'm not a great watcher of the secret scene, so I don't know if there's anything to suggest this. Like, I haven't seen a lot of crosstalk between Sandra and that group of four, the Yule and Sophie and Nick, and Wendell group. So I don't know, but actually we do see that Wendell and Sandra seem to have some rapport, but so I don't know how that plan would get hatched, but I have to think that it would have to come from that core four, would have to all be on board with it. And then that would leave out potentially Tony and Sarah. And that would just leave out Tony and Sarah and Kim potentially. Kim is clearly on the bottom of things and sort of scrambling. So she doesn't seem to have a lot of sway right now. I think that probably for Tony and Sarah, I think that Tony did find the case that Tyson was making compelling, and I totally get it. I definitely think that Tony is going to benefit from having some meat shields that go out ahead of him. But I actually think that at this point, seems to have managed his threat level and gotten into a decent position in the tribe. So maybe if he feels like the tide is really going in one direction, he's the type of guy who, and maybe with a lot of coaching from Sarah, like, not going to rock the boat at this stage in the game.
Mm-hmm. And for the from what little secret scenes or other information we were able to glean this week, it does sound like that Tyson vote was, or the idea of Tony trying to save Tyson was mostly a mirage, and that it was never seriously on the table. And I know Rob this week did the detective work and realized that you look at Tony's confessionals and then those scenes.
Right, the beard.
There is a weird facial hair situation going on that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So there's definitely some kind of break in the timeline there. So I don't know how serious that really was. And it seems like it makes almost, like, it almost feels in a way like everybody on that tribe did what they had to do in this episode, where for the Yule Alliance, you just want to keep the peace. You don't want to, you could fire a shot at like a Sarah or a Sandra, but then you let Tony and everyone else in that group know that you're onto them and create some bad blood going into a possible swap. And then you leave Tyson as this wild card who could team back up with Rob and Kim's still there too. So just taking out Tyson seems like a great vote for them. And then for the Sarah, Tony, Sandra bunch, which I don't know if that's a proper alliance or if what's going on there, given that all of them at some point have turned on the other. There's some like weird kind of a circle of life going on. Regardless of what they have, I don't think they want to risk disturbing anything there. And none of them really have a reason to trust Tyson beyond the one that Tony gave to Sandra. So you know, why not go along with the crowd and buy each of us some more time and get the obvious vote out of the way? And then for Tyson, he very cleverly zoned in on the fact that, yeah, there's an alliance of the singles potentially coming together to run this tribe right now. And I don't know how much of that is just Tyson's keen intuition versus this being basically exactly what he did to win a season himself, where he gathered together all the people who weren't connected and got them under his banner, and then they ran the game until it was too late.
So I agree. I agree that there was really no terrible gameplay this round. But I wonder, do you think that there was another angle that Tyson could have taken that could have saved himself? Or was this just a foregone conclusion?
So one thing I guess you could do is you go to the people in power, right? And if you think that the singles are running the show, you don't need to let them know that you know that, but you go to your or to Sophie and you try and make a pitch to them to why it makes sense to keep you around. Whereas instead, he was offering to lop off one of their numbers and cut away at their power. So they were never really going to get on board with that. And then meanwhile, when he's trying to get everybody else together with him, one thing that did stand out to me was there was that scene where they're sitting in the shelter and he just kind of goes and they're all gathered as a group except for Nick and maybe one or two others. And he just says, okay, it's Nick, right? It's Nick, it's Nick, it's Nick. And it seems like whenever that happens on the show, that someone gets this big group meeting together and tries to get them all on the same page in public, the moment that they walk out of the scene, everyone else just looks at each other and is like, what the hell was that? And there did seem to be a little bit of that going on here too.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I agree with both of those things. So that I was wondering if, you know, if it was a mistake for Tyson. I mean, because I think what he did so well in Blood versus Water was, and you know, this was after the swap, but he seems to be able to get together in a new group. Like he seems to be able to ingratiate himself with people pretty well. And I wonder if he could have found himself a champion in that group of four. I don't think he appreciated that they were really an alliance that was, you know, committed to voting together, and maybe that was the blind spot that he had, that that was his fatal error. But I wonder if he could have formed a pair or gotten, you know, put himself in a position where somebody in that group thought he was valuable enough that they were more interested in getting rid of somebody else.
Yeah, and that the idea that he had instead of getting that other five together maybe seemed like it could have worked, except that the moment that Sandra heard the first inklings of Tyson coming after her, he was dead to her. There was no way he was coming back from that. So that's some very heads up maneuvering by Yule, who, if anything, is playing a very like Sandra-esque game of turning people against each other and saying the right thing in everyone's ear and just but making sure that no one can ever feel good teaming up with each other. So Sandra says to close out that segment of the episode that she doesn't play emotionally. She likes having $2 million more. And she already has $2 million, to be fair, so she can do whatever she likes now. But it's an interesting self-assessment, bearing in mind that, you know, her usual tagline is, as long as it's not me. But we've seen her go out of her way in the past to, like, work towards specific outcomes. Like, it was really funny to keep Courtney around in Heroes vs. Villains. And then in Game Changers, she was the one who was, like, moving things towards, you know, JT and trying to keep Michaela around and so on. So when she wants to, she can make things happen and swing a vote the way she wants. And often that seems to be driven kind of by emotion. Not that that's a bad thing, because you know, there are lots of players out there who love to say that they're being perfectly logical, when in fact they're just going based on what side of the bed they woke up on that morning. And at least Sandra kind of owns it. But here she's almost running away from it, which was a bit confusing to see.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw on Twitter that you had a take about Sandra's self-assessment there, that she doesn't play emotional. Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably, I mean, Sandra is definitely, I think that she does use her emotions definitely in her gameplay, but she's able to, I think, deploy them pretty brilliantly oftentimes. Like, so for example, you know, being very vocal in her hatred of Russell, I think was one of the things that actually earned her a lot of goodwill in that Heroes versus Villains season. But I mean, she's definitely somebody who's motivated. I mean, in this vote, I think ultimately, I think she probably had a large role in orchestrating it from the jump that Tyson should be the target. And I think it's probably largely because she feels like she can't trust him. Like she's you know, hurt that he crossed her. She starts this whole season, you know, with a, you know, sort of declaring war on Boston Rob. So I think we're definitely going to see Sandra being influenced by her emotions. But one thing that struck me in this episode was how, you know, sort of brilliantly Sandra's anyone but me strategy, and like actually more so than that, her reputation for having that strategy is just playing out so it's really something she can use to her advantage in this game, because anytime she has a conversation with a group of people, she can just sort of say, well, you know, as long as it's not me, I'm in on this vote. And people are like, oh, okay, well, yeah, Sandra's good for that. That's, you know, her tagline. And I think it's allowing her to, you know, ironically, like, we think of her as one of the biggest threats in the game now just because of her record. I think it's allowing people to see her as a rational, reliable ally, because her strategy has just sort of been reduced to that, you know, that one phrase. And it even comes up at tribal council.
Mm-hmm. That might be an understated absence from her arsenal this season, which is the first time she played, she had Fairplay, who was going out of his way to be the villain, and then Lil, who was trying to be the hero but ended up being loathed by everybody and becoming a villain anyway. And then in Heroes vs. Villains, she has maybe the biggest villain or self-appointed villain of all time in Russell Hans. So it's very easy for her when she has a hate figure that she can turn mm-hmm. everyone against, and she's very good at doing that. On this season, there isn't really anyone who's that easy to hate, but on the other hand, you know, it's not going to be that hard to turn Boston Rob into a villain, right? Or to turn Poverty into a villain, or and so on and so forth. So I guess if she's looking at it from that angle, then there's no shortage of material to work with.
Yeah, it might be too early to tell. But I think that she's definitely, I mean, it's interesting you point that out. That is a feature of her game, that she sets herself up in opposition to somebody else. And I do feel like we're being prepared for the idea that, you know, the foil to Sandra for this season is her co-Island of the Idol, you know, common law spouse, Rob Mariano.
Yeah, and we haven't really heard his side of that feud too much yet. And when he got that fire token from Amber, he realized what it meant. And the most obvious explanation for it was that Sandra was out to get him, and this was her way of you're sending a message to him, basically. But he doesn't know that yet, and he might find that out pretty sharpish once they get to a spot here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah. Do you see them ever possibly reconciling, or is that a lost cause at this point?
I think it's a lost cause, and I think it's, I mean, also, the thing is, they're both so savvy about, like, the production and the storytelling of this product as well. And I think that, you know, they're probably, you know, they're probably at some level aware of, you know, even if I don't win this, I can, you know, get a few big episodes if I, you know, declare a blood feud with another icon of the game. So I think it's in their best interest. They're incentivized on multiple levels to play this whole thing out.
Yeah, I always wonder with these returning player seasons how much the sheer TV aspect of it all comes into things. But, like, so far the people who have been sent to the edge, you have Natalie, who would be a pretty big character on any season, but then Amber, who's pretty low-key, Danny, who's low-key, Ethan, who everybody loves, and maybe that's a reason to take him out if you're jealous of that and how much attention that's giving him. But he's also not the loudest personality, so if you're just looking to maximize your own screen time, then there's still a lot of figures to take down left in the game.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that, I wouldn't be surprised if more so than on these newbie seasons, if players are aware of that, having gone through these seasons themselves, and also, you know, being used to being edited as a winner. You know, I can imagine people being somewhat aware that, that the people who are going to be the screen time hogs, might be sucking up that time, and that could in itself make them targets.
And Tyson is, a made for TV character, so maybe we're starting to see that come into play just a little bit. But as we get into Tyson's demise here, one thing that stood out to me was he says at the end it was all too easy, and it's easy to say that in retrospect, mm-hmm. but at one point that Tyson himself has made very astutely several times on RHAP is that it's much easier to play the game having lost in a way, because you know what the signs are to look for. Like, you know when people are just brushing you off because they know you're going to be gone that night, or people aren't really putting as much work into having those conversations with you. And he has gone through that. He went through that in his first season and then almost accidentally left the game in his second season, and then he won. So his experience has all been it's been pretty upward trajectory in that regard. And now he's having the rug pulled out from underneath him. But there are people on this cast who have never had that happen. You know, they played once and they won once. And based on that, like, why would you see any need to change what you're doing or to look for anything else? Whereas Tyson has really been through the whole gamut of possible survivor experiences. So you think that he would be maybe a little more attuned to those signs.
Yeah, I mean, and you saw how unsettling it was for Kim to be the person on the outs for a vote. So, yeah, it is interesting. And I do wonder if Tyson's most recent experience, having been one of success, somehow kind of blunted his instincts in that regard. Because I do think, you know, when I was rewatching the episode a second time, you know, seeing Tyson's conversation with Yul about the vote, you know, Yul's just like, oh yeah, he messed up the challenge. He's da 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 da. Yeah, let's vote out Nick. And, you know, and I think that this has been discussed before, but when you're really, when somebody is sincerely considering a vote, they'll say, oh, okay, yeah, Nick, are you sure it should be Nick and not Wendell? Because Wendell's a threat. And so you usually have somebody who's more earnestly sussing things out with you. They'll explore other options. They'll push back. They'll ask for more justification. But, you know, when person after person is just rolling over and saying, yeah, sure, Nick, that sounds good, that should be a red flag.
Yeah, and Stephen has mentioned himself that in Cambodia, the thing that really pulled the wool over his eyes and left him getting blindsided was that on that last day, Spencer, even though he was sick, was spending hours with him just like working through scenarios in the sand and just having those same strategic conversations that they'd been having for weeks and weeks at that point. And so from Stephen's point of view, that was going to be a day just like any other. And maybe the vote itself would be complicated. But of course, Spencer was going to be on his side for that vote because just look at what he did today. And for Tyson, it did seem like people were just kind of going through the motions with him. Like, yeah, maybe we're going to just have an easy Nick vote because he messed up a challenge and he doesn't do much at camp. But you're on a season of all winners and you'd like to think that people are operating at a higher level than that.
Right, right. I mean, I think that even like in a newbie season at this era of Survivor, if somebody's telling you that somebody's the obvious boot because of challenge performance and how active they are around camp, that probably should raise red flags.
Yeah, it feels like we've seen a dozen different variations on that conversation on a regular season. And so to me, the fact that we're seeing it again with players of this caliber, if I was one of those players having that conversation, that would weird me out. I'd be like, it does feel like it should be more complicated than this on Winners at War, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, it's surprising that that Tyson wasn't able to adjust more, but I wonder if it was just like he was so backed up against a wall. I don't know if there's anything he could have done to save himself. So maybe at the end of the day, it was just wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm. So we are going to see a swap now, and that has the potential to really be the opening of a new chapter for some people, and the biggest possible danger for others. Who do you think stands to gain or lose the most from this swap here?
So let's see. I mean, at this stage, I think that looking at where the big threats shake out and what kind of protection they have is going to be critical. So people like, you know, Tony and Sarah and Sandra, they all just lost Tyson, who was, you know, in theory, one of these shields. They could definitely end up at a place where they don't have a lot of friends. I think that, you know, Rob and Parvati, they're already on the bottom. So maybe swapping, I don't know if there's a lot of connections, though, that they can make on the other side. Just kind of going quickly through it, that maybe some of those bigger threats will end up now getting targeted in these new groups. What do you think?
I'm looking at some of these low-key players who could have a big episode in a good way or a big episode in a really bad way coming up. So Kim is someone who stands out to me, who coming into the season, I was so excited to see Kim back. But instead, maybe because she's been on the bottom and, you know, the appeal of Kim is that she has this aura of invincibility around her. When that varnish is kind of chipped, then maybe she's just a less engaging personality to watch on the screen because, you know, she's not giving these really sarcastic, snarky confessionals. She's not She's not very loud. She's not like a dynamic personality in that sense, but she's just so transparently charismatic that it kind of radiates through the screen. And if she doesn't have people to be charismatic with, then, you know, what's the point of that, right? So I hope that she can find her footing, or at least try. And maybe it's going to fail, but I think she's going to make a good go at it.
Yeah, I mean, and she might be, I mean, we know that Sophie knows about her idol. So, you know, I don't know if that could bond them closer together if they end up swapped together, if that's something that Sophie might use against her. So that's, I think, a relationship to watch, what happens with Kim and Sophie. Do they end up together or apart? And how does Sophie use that information?
And then I'm also keen to see where Denise goes from here, because the one person who seemed like he was her closest ally has just revealed himself to be pretty unstable and unreliable. And maybe she decides this is the best time to jump off at that sinking ship. And we've seen her previously, her mode is survival, right? She can do exactly what she has to do to just get the target off her, lay low, get to a swap. And then we've seen her just integrate so well into that new tribe in her first season, to the point where that first vote that she went to there, everyone was coming to her. She was the swing vote. She got to decide where everything went. So it would not surprise me at all to see her right back in that same spot here.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Denise is exactly the kind of player who is pretty resilient to these kind of shakeups. And I think that that's largely why she won the season that she won. I know that she had kind of, with Adam, they had gotten themselves in a little trouble on the original Cele. But I think that what Denise's greatest strength is her ability to blend into a new group and become somebody that is seen as, she's going to be a reliable vote. She's not going to do anything crazy. She's personable to be around. So I think that all of those strengths really pay off in this part of the game.
We've spoken about some of the bigger personalities. Is there someone, maybe like a Wendell, for instance, who we've seen nothing of, but that might just be because on this first portion of the game, they don't have much to do. And then when finally they get decisions to make, that's when they really come into their own.
Yeah, so Wendell is my preseason winner pick, and I still feel very good about that choice. Wendell is one of my castmates in the Great Survivor Philadelphia YouTube series that people are invited to check out. But I think that I just have a lot of faith in Wendell's skill set. I think that he's one of these people that's kind of unflappably cool and easy to be around and a good sounding board as an ally. So I think that he has a lot of potential to get himself in a good position with a lot of these different players. And I think that we're really seeing that group of four over the Dekal group of four as being an important fulcrum in the game. So I think that, seeing how that group splits up, it will be interesting. But I also think that of those four, Wendell probably has a unique skill set that will allow him to connect with other people, be seen as less threatening potentially than somebody like Yul, who is kind of just like a walking brain, right? I think that there's ways that Wendell is a little bit more unassuming. So I think he could have the advantage of having this alliance of four, and then also being somebody who can make bridges to other alliances.
It's still so tough to imagine someone saying something negative about Wendell or just feeling badly about Wendell. And maybe we'll get to see that for the first time. And the perfect catalyst for that is being on a tribe with your ex. So maybe that's right. What breaks that record for the first time. But yeah, as you say, he seems like someone who, like, of course people are going to love Wendell. You just take it for granted. It sounds so silly that someone wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's being on a tribe with your ex. I mean, that will be, so we know now that Wendell's going to swap with Michelle, or we're assuming so. I mean, Michelle is also right now in a really good position in the game. I think that her alliance with Jeremy has really gotten itself into a position of power over at Cele. I know that Jeremy and Wendell probably are aware of mutual admiration that they have for each other. So, I mean, it could be interesting. There's a lot of bridges there, and I can see a scenario where Jeremy and Michelle can team up with Wendell and some of the other folks from that alliance, Nicole, and you know, and potentially take control later in the game.
I forget who it was in the preseason who called Jeremy and Wendell out for like horseplay or whatever at Ponderosa, where like one of them was playing with the other one's hat, and it was all a very cute bromance, but a very obvious bromance at the same time.
Yeah, they're just like so adoring of each other that they couldn't hide it during Ponderosa. Yeah, so they're, I think, a natural pair there. It's interesting that Michelle might be the link, but I think that she's in a good position. Another person I wanted to bring up before we end today is he didn't have really much of a role in this episode, but I kind of think that Ben is going to put himself in this idiot savant position this season that I think could work out really well for him. He's been a little bit doofy in the first few rounds, but throughout all of that, he's managed to be having conversations with almost everybody he needs to. He's seems to be able to stay connected to, you know, that old school and the new school. I think that there's something about the obvious kind of mistakes that he's making, like saying too much at tribal council and getting called out, that's actually going to make him seem, you know, like a non-threatening person to keep around. So I'm keeping my eye on how Ben does.
I wonder if in the spirit of that Tyson alliance of the outsiders, we might get an alliance of the new school players who feel like they're being almost disrespected by the old schoolers. So like if Adam and Ben can patch out their differences, or if Nick can maybe work his way into that, or Michelle, like if you're taking your view towards the long game, if you think you're going to have a tough time earning the respect of those people, not just in the game, but when it comes to a jury vote, then maybe it makes sense to team up with everyone else who maybe is in the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're one of these new school players, you're probably thinking that, you know, if I'm Sophie, I'd rather be sitting next to, you know, Nick and Ben than I would be sitting next to, you know, Boston Rob and Parvati. So I think that there is an incentive for those players to stick together.
Mm-hmm. And as we close this out, we don't have to take a full trip into the edit zone, but for a quick detour here, do you have your eye on anyone else from an editing standpoint? Has anyone really stood out to you so far?
So from an editing standpoint, I do feel like this, I do feel like I had, oh yes, this was something I felt like I had a strong edit take. And this is probably really stupid, but I felt like the scene where Adam can't put his torch in the hole, and like Jeff signals to Ben to go and help him, and you know, the whole tribe is watching. I felt like there was some deep significance to that, and that there's something in the relationship between Ben and Adam that we're going to see. Maybe it's not something that's going to be really relevant to the win, but I think that there's something in that relationship that might play out later in the season.
Did you feel there were any ominous overtones to when Yul was going around hugging everyone and talking about what good vibes they have at their camp, and then there was a scene shortly after of him getting hit by a wave when he was in the ocean?
Yeah, those are always fun sort of things. I mean, yeah, from an edit standpoint, like while I think in the game that some of these that the players in that group of four are in a really good position, the thing that probably casts the most doubt on that is that, you know, we just haven't seen them featured as much in the edit, and maybe that's because Dekal was was less relevant in the episodes where they didn't go to tribal council. And when you go over to Dekal, you want to get as much Tyson and Tony and Sarah and Sandra, or Tyson and Tony and Sandra, maybe more so, but you wanted to get as much of those players in with those opportunities. But I do feel a little concerned that we haven't seen them highlighted more in the edit.
One possible exception to that for me would be Sophie, who even in that period of relative silence still pops up every episode and has something sharp and insightful to say. And I thought that visiting the prison analogy this episode was fantastic, and I'm glad they found a way to put that in there.
Yeah, no, that was a great confessional. I took a couple of notes about that, and I was wondering if that was just that was just a good way to highlight how the players in the game were thinking about Edge, or if it was portending anything specific about Sophie's future with Edge of Extinction. But I definitely thought that that was a good confessional that they may have included anyway, but could be foreshadowing something to come.
Mm-hmm. Anyone from Sele, yes, from the other tribe that they have been the focus for a lot of the episodes so far. With that in mind, has there been anyone who you think has a long-term future based on that?
So I think that if I can channel the Colin Stone theory of edit reading, I feel like it should be represented, but that the idea is that I think that the person whose content is being manipulated to an extent that, like, what would we show, no matter what, and what are we showing because we're trying to highlight this particular individual. I think that the edit's best friend, Michelle Fitzgerald, might be getting some more elevated content than just the entertainment value of that content would necessarily suggest. And while I think that that conversation between Michelle and Rob was really, really interesting, I also think that it was a departure from the types of things that they usually include. So it made me think that having that conversation included had some kind of significance.
I fear you may be right. How do you feel about her partner in crime, Jeremy, at this point? He's someone we haven't talked about that much so far, but things seem to be going great for him too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Jeremy is, he's an excellent survivor player, and I really enjoy watching him. He hasn't been heavily featured, but he's in a good position. And I find like the small moments where you see, you know, him listening and not reacting and reacting. I mean, I loved when Rob comes to call out Jeremy and Michelle about Parvati being the target, and Jeremy's just like, I'm just gonna smile and shake my head, and Rob wasn't buying it. But I think that Jeremy has a great strategic mind, and I think he has a lot of social savvy. So I like him as a potential long-term player. I think that it probably bodes well for him that Natalie is over on Edge and is really good at finding these advantages, and we can only imagine that at some point things might flow back to Jeremy. It doesn't seem like that's her strategy with fire tokens right now, but at some point that could benefit him. So I like his chances. I think he hasn't been flashy in the edit to this point, but it's tough to read that when he's on a tribe with Boston Rob and Parvati, who has actually gotten, you know, maybe less attention than I would expect. But, Survivor loves Boston Rob, and they're going to give you a lot of Boston Rob any episode that they can. There's a lot going on with Adam. So there's a lot of people competing for that screen time, and yet we're still seeing things from Jeremy pretty consistently, although not overwhelmingly. So I think that he is definitely a contender.
Mm-hmm. Any general hot takes or fun things you want to put out there into the ether before we get out of here for the night?
I guess the one thing we didn't talk about too much was fire tokens. I'm sort of in on fire tokens right now. I'm really interested to see how this shakes out. I guess that there's not much interesting new developments from this episode, but I think that the fact that, you know, Natalie is accruing these and people don't even necessarily know that she has them. What do you think about Natalie's strategy in terms of who she's been feeding these advantages to?
it's tough to know how much of it is with an eye to if she does come back, how useful it's going to be versus, hey, I'll do it because, you know, Jeremy's my friend and Sarah, you know, I want to see her cause some chaos and I think she can do it. You never know how much of this is really intentional in that way. I don't know how much that is going to matter either. I think if she gets back into the game, she's going to have bigger things to worry about than who she gave a fire token right. to when.
Yeah, it seems to me right now like her principal concern is just making the sale, right? Like, I don't think that she's thinking so much about, like, who do I want to connect with? I think she's trying to think of who's definitely going to buy this advantage. And, like, I guess that with Sarah, you know, when there was the advantage that was involved invading the camp, she wanted somebody that was going to be willing to take that risk or see a value in the payoff. She's seems to be a little concerned that people might be spending their fire tokens. So I'm just curious to see, like, if there's ever a point where people come together to spend fire tokens on anything. Like, I know that there's some tribe items that people can spend fire tokens, but I mean, I'll be interested to see, like, when, if it ever comes into play, a moment when the tribe needs to know how many fire tokens they have collectively and how that's managed, if people start to talk amongst themselves about trading and amassing them. But right now, I think everybody has one, and the items that, or everybody started with one, and the items that Natalie has found have cost one fire token. So I think if those prices go up, it'll be interesting to see how she makes that decision based on who she assumes might have enough money in the bank to purchase the item. Mm-hmm.
I almost don't know if I want these fire tokens to have a big impact on things. Like, if Natalie waltzes into the return challenge and just effortlessly wins it based on the advantages that she's been able to build up since the first day there, like, that doesn't feel like a good thing. But at the same time, I don't want them to go through all of this hassle of inventing this new economy and putting it into the game if it's not going to do anything in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I almost feel like just make it a survivor auction. And, like, mm-hmm. one of the things on the table is going back into the game or something. I mean, or, you know, maybe this is, I think that at some point Jeff says we figured out a way to bring the survivor auction back. So I think that right now my theory would be that these fire tokens come into play in some sort of auction scenario. And I would be okay if one of the items in the auction was just buying your way back into the game, and whoever had amassed the most tokens is going to get that by default.
Okay. If that was, like, the only way of coming back, or is there some other aspect here that you have in mind?
I mean, I don't know. I think that it's fine if that's the only way coming back. I mean, I'd rather watch that than, like, watch people, you know, like, do a ring toss.
I mean, I'd rather watch most challenges and watch someone do a ring toss, but that does seem to be where we're at
okay,
nowadays.
Okay, wait, yeah. So they go through a long obstacle course and then they do a ring toss.
How long is this obstacle course? Like, how grand are we talking here?
It's medium grandness. I don't know. I guess I'm sort of, I think that I don't know. I think I would prefer if it was purely that this kind of economic mechanism for getting back into the game. You know, because I'm a capitalist to my bones, and I think that that's the way that we should handle it.
Yes.
No, I guess it's just something different. It would add some variety.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the spirit of that, any final closing takes to light the fire under people as we send them on their way?
people should watch Survivor Philadelphia.
Yes. Where can they find that if they're so inclined?
Yeah, you can find it on YouTube. If you Google Survivor Philadelphia, it was produced by Alex G, who you might know from the RHEP Wandoffs, and it stars me and also Bryce Isaiah from Cagayan and Wendell Holland from the present season of Survivor. So if you're thinking that you're not getting enough of Wendell on Wednesday nights, you can go to YouTube and watch Survivor Philadelphia.
Or enough of Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz on this episode, you know, if you've
whetted
that appetite
exactly.
a little bit, and now all they want is more.
Exactly, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, thank you, as always, for coming on. where can people find you if they want to be checking out your takes on non-survival related things?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. I'm A Rabinow, A-R-A-B-I-N-O-W. And I please follow me. I occasionally will tweet about reality television. I will more often tweet about brain injury rehabilitation. So if you are the rare person who is interested in both of those topics, then I'm definitely the person you should be following.
I think you are that rare person, but given that you can't follow yourself, this is the next best thing. Exactly. You can, as always, be finding me on Twitter at DomHRV. Follow me if you like, but you really don't have to. You can find Colin when he's back at Colin Stone. And you can find us in here every week talking about Survivor, as well as at other points during the week for various one-off Survivor and non-Survivor related things. But I think that's going to do it for this week. So thank you again for tuning in, and we will talk to all of you again soon. Take care, everyone.